Hello, welcome to the Naked Podcaster. Today I have on me with me Jen Landels. Jen, how are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm great. You're in Vancouver.
Close to, yeah, Langley, okay. Which is okay. About an hour away.
I'm trying to think. And that is West Coast of Canada.
Yes.
In BC.
Yeah.
Okay. So I drove to Alaska to and from a couple different times. And so I drove through probably part of where, kind of close to where you are. And
probably,
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. So I have several websites with you, which is really exciting. I am really excited to talk to you. The first thing is I'm going to go on my Facebook Live and I'm going to tag Mickey, who is the person that connected us. I love that. The first thing that I have is jmlandels.stiffbunnies.com, which is your author. So jump into everything that you are doing right now, and then we'll go back in time and you can share your story of how you got to where you are.
Sure. So I'm an author and a publisher and instructor of riding and mounted combat. And I run a barn and I do too many things.
I know. I looked at your information. I was like, what? How does she do this? So this website, the jmlandels at .stiffbunnies.com, and everybody will have all of the links. What is this? These are your books.
So yeah, that's just primarily my author website. Although I do put some of my mounted combat and swordplay stuff up there. Most of my swordplay stuff goes on academycavallo.ca, which you may not have that link, but I can send it later.
No, I do. I do. That okay. Was the third one I had in okay. a row when I'm looking at them. Okay.
Yeah. So, I guess, you know, author is not what I make the most money doing, but I guess it's my primary job in that it's what I've always wanted to be. So I do have two novels out and a third one coming out later this year. And another one I'm working on as well.
So it's Overture and Aria. Correct?
Yeah, those are the two that are out now.
And what's kind of the genre, the backstory on them?
So Elenia's Song, it's a trilogy. It's high fantasy. It's, you know, on the surface, it's about magic and music, which kind of ties into my background as a musician. But really what it is a story about mothers and daughters. So it's the story takes the lives of Elenia, the main character, her mother and her grandmother when they were younger women, and kind of braids them all together. And, you know, it's about the fantasy element is that Elenia has this power to be able to sing music into magic. And it's slightly, it's a dangerous power and it's slightly illegal and something she has to hide, which she inherited from her grandmother. And then the stories are really about the relationship, the lies and the secrets that this family tells each other, and how they get through that. And then another facet too is it's a Bildungsroman. So the German term of the story of how a young person becomes a hero. Mm. So it's really the story of how Elenia evolves into the hero that she's meant to be.
Wow. Now they're on this website and I have them listed in Facebook and I'll have them everywhere else. Can you get them on Amazon?
Yep.
Yay. I buy the book of every single person who's on my podcast. You have a trilogy. If people have like 27 books, I'm like, pick one and lead me to one. But I am really excited to be able to get them and look at them. I want to go over the about me on you here because like you said, you're a writer, you do your own illustrations.
I did do illustrations. Originally, the first novel was serialized in Pulp Literature, and I did pencil illustrations for that. Then when we put out the first book, my colleague Mel Anastasia did wonderful ink. She inked those illustrations to turn them into pure black and white. But then we decided not to do that for the second and third books because honestly, illustrations take up a lot of space, and we didn't feel that they needed it in novel form. It was nice in the magazine because it's an illustrated magazine. And also I just ran out of time. I stopped doing the drawings because I ran out of time. And my mother's nagging me to get the third book out.
Oh,
So
really? Well, you
she's like,
know, I
come
mean,
on, I'm not going to live
come
forever here.
I mean, that's a little morbid, but that's, you know, it's all right. Okay. We'll work with that. That is just a little pressure there. I'm going to keep going. So you are actually, are you self-published or are you a publisher, like in the sense of a publishing house? You create a publishing house?
So Pulp Literature is a publishing house. So that's a nonprofit organization. Yes, I publish my books through them. So in a sense, it's self-published, but the books go through, another team. So they go through developmental editing and copy editing and proofreading and kind of, I hand it off to the rest of the team.
That's great.
So
I know a lot of authors become kind of their own publishing house because you can have everything in one place that you use and you can help other people. That wasn't the route that I went, but I completely understand the draw to do it that way. So that's amazing. Do you help other people get their books published?
yeah, we've Well, Pulp Literature primarily is a fiction magazine, so we mostly do short stories. We have published, we have Advent, which was a debut novel by Michael Kamakana, who's a Calgary slash Hawaiian writer. So he's based in two countries. That was an amazing debut science fiction novel, very stream of consciousness, way out there. Not an easy read, but a really worthwhile one. And then we've published Matthew Hughes' What the Wind Brings. So Matt Hughes is a well-known science fiction writer. He's a well-known crime writer, but this is historical fiction, and this is what he considers his magnum opus. He actually got a Canada Council grant to write the book, so the writing was paid for. But he couldn't get a publishing, he couldn't get one of the big publishers interested in it. And we had published a short story of his. So he approached us and said, "Are you interested?" And we took a look at the manuscript and we fell in love with it. Because it's about these native tribe in South America that meets a slave ship from a Spanish slave ship that shipwrecks there. So the freed slaves or the escaped slaves and the native tribe band together to actually gain independence. And it's actually based on a true story. This is how the Zambo Nation in Ecuador came to be. So it's this amazing sweeping epic, which was completely out of Matt's usual wheelhouse. And so we took that on and I think we did a pretty good job with it. We did hard covers, so which was pretty exciting to actually do a
Wow, that's
proper hard
incredible.
cover with, cloth binding and all
Wow.
that sort of stuff. So yeah, we don't publish a lot. And then we have another novel by Brenda Carr, which we're just working on right now. We haven't got a publication date for that.
That's amazing. What an amazing gift. You know from doing your own book how challenging it is to get from inception to conception, you know? I mean, it takes a lot to do that. I love that. I love that you're doing that. Tell me, you mentioned musician and you're a musician and a dancer. So let's jump in there because after that, it gets really interesting.
My road to becoming a musician was kind of weird because I started out I did an air band in university with cardboard guitars, and my it was just like one of these air band competitions. My girlfriends and I in university won this competition. We got invited to actually open for local bands. So we opened for the Scramblers, which is an amazing local band in Vancouver at the time. And you know, that just kind of my partner is an amazing guitarist. So it's like at that point it's like, okay, teach me how to play guitar. And he's an amazing guitarist. He's not a great teacher because he's so good at it. But between him and I started to pick up guitar, and then we moved to the UK in the 90s, and I sort of joined a music collective happening at a local community center, did some work with them, and then joined an all-girl band. Did that for several years.
I love that. All right, so you play guitar.
Play guitar, and eventually I did vocals as well. I went through several bands, as one does. But the last gig I played was the Vogue Theater when I was 6 months pregnant with my firstborn. So my guitar was out here.
That's so great. I sang in bands too. I still have my guitar that I need to learn to play. So there you go. Now, you also, a question, and I know that that's a huge part of your journey growing up that we'll go into. Equestrian and sword fighter. So, this is where I'm like, all right, there's several different spokes to this wheel. This is exciting. So, tell me a little bit about being an equestrian and a sword fighter.
So the equestrian is something I've done. I like to say I was riding before I could walk. So I've always been horse crazy. My first full sentence was, "I want a horse." And I did eventually get one, and have had several since. Sword fighting is something that I picked up over a decade ago now, I guess closer to 12 or 13 years ago. It's not true. I used to do classical fencing a little bit and some wushu sword. I was researching for a novel, and I was researching 17th century rapier, and then I found there was a school in Vancouver where I could actually learn to fight with a 17th century rapier. So I joined Academy Duello. I dragged my partner with me, and we've been doing rapier and longsword, spear, things like that ever since.
Wow. What a great way to get into it. So you kind of really got into a character there.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and it kind of derailed. I didn't actually start writing that novel again until just a couple of years ago, which particular historical novel that I was researching. And at some point, I guess around 2010, I said to the director of Academy Duello, Devin Borman, I said, "Look, I've got horses, you've got swords, we should do something with those together." So I came up with the mounted combat program, put together a curriculum, started running classes, and then just last year I split that off into a separate school, Academy Cavallo,
Okay,
which
so that I have this up, and you do courses. Holy cow. Okay, that it is great to have the background of this. So dive in deep on the Academy Covello, because this is incredible.
I live here on my farm, which is 12 acres out in Langley. We have an indoor riding arena, a nice facility here, and we give classes. So we teach people how to ride, we teach people how to care for horses, and we teach people how to sword fight, and then eventually how to put those together. So we do during COVID, we haven't had any tournaments or anything like that, but we have been able to continue with classes. So every Sunday, we've got people out here learning to ride and sword fight from horseback.
It's a really incredible website. I hope people go on. I mean, like, I don't live near you. I couldn't even do it if I was dying to, because you're too
Oh,
far
but we
away.
have
But
online
yeah,
classes.
okay. I just saw it. I was like, but I mean, I couldn't be at your place riding a horse, but the pictures are phenomenal. The pictures on here, you could just get sucked into this website. They're absolutely beautiful. And you have these training these horses, what's that like? I mean, you're talking about training the people to ride and the people to sword fight, but what about the horses themselves?
The horses are actually easier to train than the people.
Why am I not surprised? Okay.
horses don't tend to overthink things, that's why. I mean, all you really need is you need a horse that's well trained, just a basic riding horse. It doesn't need to be anything special. Horse that can walk, trot, and canter, and is relatively responsive to your leg and voice and hand commands is all you really need. And then we go through a process of introducing them to weapons gradually, and most of them take to it really well. There's very few horses that really don't like it. I've come across like one or two in the last 10 years that don't really take to it at all. So we start with a sword, and they're nylon swords because we don't, if we miss and hit the horse, we don't want to do that with a steel sword. Because they didn't ask for this. And so we start, we run the sword on either side of their head. We do a process of sacking the horse out. Sacking out means, introducing it to things. We scratch, and every time we get on a horse, even, my horse is so used to swords that she falls asleep when I get on her back with a sword, even though she's a very hot thoroughbred most of the time. But we every time we get on with a sword, we scratch them between the ears with it. We run it over their flanks. We do that just process of checking in with them every time. And most of them are quite fine with that. And then, once we've introduced them to the sword by itself, we start introducing them to other horses because they have to learn to come at other horses and face other horses and stand shoulder to shoulder. And that's probably the hardest thing for horses to do because they don't tend in a herd, they don't tend to come at each other face to face. That's an aggressive move. So we do have to train them to come, sort of walk towards each other calmly and eventually canter and things like that. We get them used to the sound of the swords making, just the tapping them against each other. And we also introduce them to other longer weapons like spears, which are essentially just, big 6 or 10 feet pieces of doweling, and bows as well. So we do, we also do archery, although again, we haven't done that group archery for a year just because of COVID. But yeah.
Wow, so on your free time.
What free time?
I mean, that's incredible. So how much is the process similar to, we watch these old movies of the knights with their big, that would be more like a kind of a spear or a dowel, where they came at each other to try to knock each other off.
So that's jousting.
Jousting, thank you.
And we don't do jousting. There are a lot of places that do. Mainly I'm not as interested in jousting because again, really, you're running at each other and trying to knock each other off. You get a lot of shoulder injuries, a lot of falls. It's not as complex as doing a melee with swords where you have to circle each other and find measure and come in and out. There's more interesting things to do with a sword than just a simple joust.
They
But
come, do they come at each other the same way?
well, we tend to start off coming towards each other, but it's a lot of circling. So
What
it's
are
a
the odds of you being in a movie that I'm thinking, like there was a series called Outlander where there's a lot of sword fighting from horses. I would think that that would be a great segue into that because there can't be a lot of people who do something this niche specific.
Well, we have been approached to use the horses before with the movie industry, and none of those have ever actually panned out for various reasons. But we don't do the historical costumes, so we don't have our horses aren't dressed up in the barding and things like that. So it's very much a modern interpretation of historical sources. But yeah, I mean, it's like I said, we have, and I did actually, I did do a private training session for one of the stars of Heartland, which is a horse show on CBC. Did archery training for her. So we've had actors come to us to learn how to do this as well.
Yeah, I would imagine that would be a kind of a secondary, almost accidental niche to tap into.
It's a great thing to put on your acting resume, right? That you can ride and sword fight.
Yeah, because I can't, so I wouldn't be a good cast, for that. Tell me about pulpliterature.com.
So Pulp Literature is a fiction magazine.
Ah, got it. Good
So this
books.
is yeah, so this is the magazine here,
Okay.
which is it's book sized,
It's
right? It's about 200 pages, 200 to 250 pages.
okay.
Quarterly magazine and short fiction, novel excerpts, poetry, usually a graphic novel or comic in each issue as well.
Excellent. That's a huge magazine. I mean, that's pretty intense. So that is part of what you do through the publishing company then.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So that was the start of the publishing company. My colleagues, Mel Anastasia and Susan Peters and I were just sitting on Mel's deck drinking beer in the sunshine, and we thought, we know a lot of writers. We had a lot of
Right.
connections with writers, and there's just not a lot of short fiction magazines in Canada, especially for genre short fiction. There's a fair number of literary magazines, usually through universities, but not a lot for genre fiction. And so, we thought, well, why don't we just run a Kickstarter to produce the first issue, see if there's interest. So we did that. We ran a first Kickstarter and raised enough money to get us started on our first year of publishing. For our first issue, I approached Chris Humphreys, CC Humphreys, historical writer, and we were rehearsing a stage fight for the release of his novel, Shakespeare's Rebel. So that was taking place at Bard on the Beach, which is our local Shakespeare theater. And so while we were rehearsing this stage fight over beer afterwards, I said, "Hey, have you got any short stories in a shoebox under your bed?" And he said, "Why, yes, I do." And so that was he had a contemporary short story, and he said, "Well, it's not historical. Is that okay?" I said, "That's perfect, because what we want from our feature authors is something that they don't normally write." So we had a contemporary piece from him. And then right after that, I approached J.J. Lee, who's a memoirist, award-winning memoirist here in Canada, and said, "Do you have anything?" And it's like, "Yeah, can I write a story about killer teddy bears?" And it's like, "Yes, you can." So those were our first two issues, and those were the you can, and J.J. Lee actually drew he actually painted the cover himself for the killer teddy bears.
Wow. That's great.
And then yeah, we got Joan McLeod, who's an award-winning playwright, to write a sort of historical fiction set in the 70s. We got Susanna Kearsley, who's a romance writer. She gave us a zombie story set in William Wallace's Scotland.
Well, you need a
So,
zombie. You got to throw a zombie in there if you have killer teddy bears. I mean, so the last thing on your list of how amazing you are, you mentioned that you're a mom, I know you've had at least one child. You're a childbirth educator and doula. So I love finding commonalities. So we're both authors, childbirth educators, doulas, moms, and musicians.
Wow.
I
And we're both
know.
gens.
And we're both gens. That's not as uncommon, but
No, it's not.
how great. So tell me a little bit about mom, childbirth educator, doula.
Well, it started with mom. So I had my first child in 95, and that was and I had a midwife. Now, midwifery, home births were not legal in Canada at that point, so I could have a midwife, but it had to be a hospital birth. So I went through that process, which was wonderful and great, but I just kind of got more interested through a bit through Mothering Magazine, which was a magazine. I don't know if you know that one. So then I found a childbirth educators course through local community college, and I did that in between my first and my twins. So I took that course. I hadn't really started teaching yet, but I had taken the course and I'd done, I'd gotten my certificate. Then I had my twins, which was wonderful that I had taken the course before, because then I knew enough to fight for what I wanted with a twin birth, which is not easy to do. So even though I had planned a home birth and I had the pool and everything, because by that time it was legal in Canada, it's like I found out at 36 weeks that I had twins. It's like at 36 weeks, because I skipped the ultrasound. I said, I don't need to know. I don't need to know what sex it is. I'm fine. Everything's good. My blood, everything was fine. But then all of a sudden at 32 weeks, I got like 36 centimeter fundal height. So it was like, everything's getting big here. And it's like, what's going on? We went for an ultrasound, and oh yeah, there's two babies in there. And so there were a lot of tears over the loss of my home birth. And because this was not my first child, I knew exactly how much work one baby was, and the thought of two was just like,
I can't imagine finding out that far in the like that. That would be really hard.
but it was a blessing in disguise, because I had been with midwives all along, so I was low risk and my blood pressure was low. As soon as I found out I had twins, my blood pressure went through the roof. But at that point, at 36 weeks, not a big deal. Oh, we're expecting these babies to be born any day. As it turns out, I went to 40 weeks plus 2 days with them.
How lucky.
So they were huge. They were bigger than my first baby. They were 8, 9, and 8, 10.
Not lucky. Sorry.
So 17 pounds, 3 ounces of baby. I
Oh
was like a
my
ship.
gosh.
But they were so healthy, right? Like, I was able, and the midwives were able to stay. I still needed an obstetrician at the birth. And he did an internal version for the second twin, who was Breech. But it was just, it was so normal. I did most of my labor at home. I got to hospital. I was able to not have an epidural. They compromised. They insisted that I put in a saline lock at second stage. That was the first time I felt pain during the whole labor. I caught the first one myself and held her on my chest. And then the most painful part experience in my entire life was that internal version, because that's somebody's. A man's hand up inside,
Moving things around.
grabbing feet, pulling her out. But then I was able to go home the same day, so with two healthy babies. So it really was a blessing that A, I was educated enough as a childbirth educator to be able to, insist on what I wanted, and that I didn't want a epidural, and I didn't want, pain medication, because I knew that that would keep me there longer. And that I found out so late, because if I'd known at 18 weeks, when most people find out, my blood pressure would have been through the roof and I would have become high risk. So.
My first baby, I had a midwife at a birth center. You couldn't have a home birth. And I don't think I was probably quite ready to do that. And she transferred me to the hospital, and I still had the birth that I wanted for the most part. That was a good, just like you, a good experience. She was very sick, so it was a blessing that I had transferred. And my midwife, this is the great thing about people in this profession. She just intuitively said, "You're 37 weeks and something's not right. And you need to transfer." There was no questioning. There was no talking her out of it. She knew something was off, and it was in my daughter's health. So that was in 1992. But my next three were home births, two in the water. And I think I was a childbirth educator. I was a lactation consultant and a childbirth educator. And then I was training to be a midwife and a doula. And I never completed the midwife. But I think that when you take that from an instructional perspective, your knowledge is so high that stuff just doesn't really bother you. Like, having twins and knowing you could still do it the way you wanted to do it, because your experience may be less, but your knowledge is pretty vast. So I love that. I love that. Wow, how cool. That's great. Are you still doing it?
No, I gave up childbirth education at a when the twins were around 7 years old. And it was kind of like it was interesting because you know how they say how you replace every cell in your body after 7 years? So it was like I had replaced every cell in my body that was sort of involved in birth and that sort of thing. And I felt like I was ready to move on. Like I still am passionate about childbirth, and I'm still, I still see things that make my blood boil, when I see intervention rates and breastfeeding rates and things like that, which just keep, doing this depressing up and down thing. But and occasionally, since then I have done some doula work, but I like to say it's friends, family, and repeat offenders. So.
But yeah, me too. Repeat offenders, that's great. I stopped after 11 years. I part of me wishes I had kept it going. Hindsight's great. But I did it for 11 years, and now my daughter, who's 25 and due with her second baby, is
Oh, wow.
licensed and certified to be a doula and a lactation consultant. So it sort of, it's just a really, it's great to have more people in the world who are trying to make that a more beautiful experience instead of the opposite.
That's
So,
lovely.
wow, that was a rabbit hole. I'm so glad I asked you about this. So the podcast is about your struggles and kind of the who, what, when, where, how you got through them. So I'd like to kind of jump back in time. You mentioned that you were on a horse before you could walk, and that you owned your first one. I don't remember if you said that when you owned your first one, but let's jump back in time and tell me, let's start talking about your story.
I grew up partially in a log cabin in the woods, or a cabin in the, it wasn't even a log cabin, honestly. It was a, I guess you'd call a tar paper shack at some point. Single mom. My dad was in the picture, but he lived in a town half an hour away. And I saw him every second weekend I'd spend with him. We did not have a lot of money. My mom spent the first years of my life just at home on welfare. And then she started working. She was a physiotherapist. I mean, she still is, I guess. Just not a practicing one. But she started working in the hospital sort of 3 days a week, part-time, so that she could still be home when I got home from school. So, even though it was a very isolated childhood, and not a very, like we weren't well off or anything, it was actually a very rich childhood because, she was there for me. I was not a latchkey kid. I just didn't have all the fancy clothes and shoes, but I never felt the lack of that. And I had a pony, like because we lived on acreage, she got 24 acres from her from her parents. So there was, they had a core section divided up between three kids. So we had land. It wasn't, and she still lives there, and she still lives in a log house up there in her 80s. But you know, we had the ability to keep a horse, and yeah, like I said, my first sentence was, "I want a horse." And when I was eight, my dad, I mean, probably out of some parental guilt, you know, for being a an absentee dad or, you know, the separated parents, got me that pony. So, yeah, it was like, you know, a lot of people would have said, you know, that was a childhood of hardship and with no running water, and I had to haul water and you know, cut wood. I learned how to use an axe at a very young age, but I didn't feel the hardship. It was a wonderful childhood from my point of view. I just had a lot of freedom and a lot of loneliness, which was excellent because it made me more creative. It made me write more. And yeah, so it was a great childhood in that respect. And you know, it's funny. I've been through lots of struggles in my life, but once I'm through them, they don't feel like struggles anymore. You know what I mean? They feel like, okay, that was helpful. It was, may not have felt it at the time, but it was helpful.
That's a great way to see it. I think all of us process things differently. So I mean, I process, even looking back as a little kid, you know, at six, not maybe in the moment, but like you said, when it's over, I was always searching for the silver lining, which is why I love to do these interviews to find out what other people, what was the joy that you got out of the struggle, you know? So carrying your own water is a big deal. What most of us, I would think, is extreme. And you felt like it was something that was building your character.
Well, yeah, I just it felt it was kind of it was just kind of cool and special. And like, you know, yeah, so I did miss not being able to visit my friends, right? You know, you had to drive to town or but I would see my friends at school. And you know, I felt like, you know, if I lived in town in a house, I wouldn't have a pony in my backyard and chickens and a dog and 24 acres to go and you know, hop on my pony's back and just ride wherever I wanted.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, that's really very amazing to be able to have that kind of freedom. So move us forward a little bit in growing up. I know what happened like after you went and got a PhD, or I know one thing, but there's a gap of age there. So fill us in on how you got there.
I didn't actually get the PhD. I started the PhD, but yeah, so high school, you know, high school, I was, again, a small town. Ashcroft is not a fabulous, like, there's not a lot to do. I spent a lot of time playing Dungeons and Dragons and, you know, other role playing games, which were fairly new at the time. You know, I had a boyfriend, and, you know, we were together for 6 years, including into university. We came down to university together. And it wasn't a great relationship. It was, you know, it was okay, but you know, he had a temper. You know, he could be emotionally abusive, but I felt sorry for him. I didn't leave him because I felt sorry for him. I think a lot of women do that, right? Just, you know, they feel like you want to care for this person. And then we, you know, we went down to we both went to UBC, University of British Columbia, and we moved into residence together. And then after that second year, when we were in sort of couples residence, we decided to rent a house. So this was a large group house with seven people total, seven people living in a in a big house in Vancouver. And the last person that we found, so these were people we had met online, and these were the early days of online. So it was, it was the UBC intranet, really. And that we were on several forums, and people we'd sort of got together and knew through these forums. We rented this house. The last person we found to rent it is the person who ended up being my partner, still my partner. So we thought, oh, he won't want to come with us. He's still living at his parents' place. Why would he want to rent? You know, but he did. And then 2 years in that house of shared living, by the end of it, he and I were the only two people that could stand each other. So
I completely understand that. Having been to university and sharing with six people, I completely understand that.
And not only that, we quite liked each other. So, you know, he was the one who went grocery shopping with me. He was the one who cleaned up after himself. It's having a group house is a great way to pick a potential mate, because you see which ones are slobs and
oh yeah,
which ones take responsibility.
Oh yeah. Don't you find that with your kids now that they've gotten older too? A lot of hours have moved out and we'll go visit and I'm like, okay, I know you know how to clean a bathroom. I know you were taught that, but yeah, I know you're right. Find the kid in university who's cleaning up. Yes.
Yeah.
So at what point did your relationship break up and you guys admit that you cared for each other?
The last about 4 months before we moved out of that first house. We pretty much have a party every weekend, but we just end up being the two people sitting talking to each other, or we kind of finally admitted we were attracted to each other. And then a bunch of us moved into a second house for the summer, and it was during that phase that I actually broke up with my then boyfriend. I actually kept paying rent there and went and house sat for somebody else for a month, and the whole, you know, messy separation with, you know, quite a lot of anger on his part, and then my current partner and I moved in the fall back into the university housing, and that's I was like, I said to him at the time, I'll go out with you, but you must never ask me to marry you. This was like, because this was my previous boyfriend was like, had like given me a ring, like a sort of promise ring, before graduation. And it was like a weight. I felt it was like this weight on me all the time, having this ring. And I didn't even, you know, I stopped wearing it. I put it on a chain around my neck. But it was just a weight. And so I said to Chris, my husband, partner, whatever, you must never ask me to marry you. So we moved into residence. And then when that year was over, we moved to an apartment. And then I went away to England. And I went away. I said, I got a one-way ticket. I don't know how long I'm going for. I'm just doing the grand tour thing. I went to England and Europe. And I met up with some friends over there, who were also doing the traveling thing, and traveled a bit. And after a couple of months, I realized, you know, that I really missed him, and I wanted to come home. And so we came home, and we've been together. We moved back to England together, like less than a year later. We stayed there for 4.5 years. We moved back here, had kids, and we're still together. I mean, we've been together longer than most married couples. So
yeah, how many years has it been since you guys moved in together that first place?
So 30, I'm thinking,
yeah,
years. Yeah, 32, 33.
Yep. I have, so in your, when you made the appointment, the information I have, you acquired your degree in medieval English literature, correct?
Yes,
Okay,
bachelor's degree. Yeah.
that really shows me some of the jousting and writing and stuff connection, I guess. I would think
Yeah,
some of,
I've always been
not,
interested in history, right? So
right,
I
not the jousting, the fence, the sword play. Yeah, it
yeah.
ties into that.
Yeah.
Also, it says that you went to London to get a PhD in English, but instead dyed her hair pink and joined a rock band. And I was like, yes, I can't wait. This is gonna be awesome. So tell me about that one.
Well, we moved again. We just pulled up after I had been over for that one summer,
Right.
and then I came back, spent the winter here in Vancouver, and I said to Chris, I said, well, they need computer scientists over there so badly. Like they did not. He has a bachelor's in computer science, and they people working over there did not even have bachelor's degrees, right? They were just like trying to find people, and it's like you could get a job so easily. So he started doing a bit of a job search, and I applied for graduate school. So I applied a number of places, and then I hadn't accepted. I had a few offers, I hadn't accepted them, but in May of that year, we pulled up roots. We even missed his brother's wedding to do that, which is probably a bit of a family no-no. But we pulled up roots. We had, I think, $800 in savings, and we just flew over there on a one-way ticket. We found a place to stay. He had job interviews lined up, and he landed his job fairly quickly. And we also went and I went up to Leeds to interview for a master's up there, and I eventually decided on University of London. And it was just I just wanted to be in London more than I wanted to be in Leeds. So I still kind of regret not, because it was I really like the faculty, head of faculty there. But so I started that. I started doing my degree. We got ourselves a flat in North London, and I was working on it. And then the province of BC, I'd asked for a loan. I think it was $13,000 to pay for a con that didn't even cover tuition. That was just accommodation. And the government said, no, you don't need, you only need, actually, no, I'd only asked for the loan for tuition, which was about $4,000, quite expensive at the time. And they said, no, you only need $13,000 a year to live. And we were paying $1,000 a month for a flat where, the wind blew through and the carpets would lift, and it was, the roof leaked in our bedroom, and it was not a luxury flat by any stretch of the imagination. So I just went, and I was a term in, like I was already at Christmas by the time they got back to me and said no. And it's like, well, I can do a PhD at any part of my life. I can only be in a rock band when I'm young. So
That was a great choice. I like that choice a lot. I would like to know, because you have this ability to kind of jump into things that from the outside seem like they would be scary, from fencing to going to London on a one-way ticket twice with no money and no plan, kind of. What allows you in your personal, like, how do you do that? What inspires you to do that?
I think growing up without a lot of money made me realize that it's not that important. That I've always kind of felt like the universe kind of looks after me, right? Like it's like, and I mean, I'm not a religious person, but it's just like it. When things are needed, they show up. And I don't quite know how that works, whether that works on a quantum level, or whether there actually is a God, I don't know. But it's kind of like intention. It's like you put your intention forward as this is what I want. When your intention is on something, you notice the things that will help you make that intention a reality. So it's like, and we knew that we knew before we went over that Chris had job offers. So we knew that he would be able to get a job. We knew it was incredibly expensive to live in London at the time. Now it's just as expensive to live here, but it's still pretty expensive there. But we, it's like, and we were thinking, well, we could get a loan from, student loan. All that fell through, but turns out he didn't need it. You just kind of, I find the most reward happens in life when you take the most courageous steps, right? So yeah, it was a big leap, and we've done other big leaps too, like buying this place we're at now. Like, this is a huge mortgage we have, and like it's a big mortgage payment, and we're making it. It's working. But when we were deciding, like, because we'd been at our house in Richmond for 18 years, and like making this huge move to sell that and move out to an acreage, which is like so much more work and so much more, we had paid our mortgage off on our other house. It's like we're going back into being mortgaged at, in our 50s. But it was kind of like, and Chris said, he said, well, we've made these leaps before and it's always worked out. And it has. And he made other leaps before. One, when the first place he worked in London, they did a big layoff, and they were offering big severance packages, or keeping them on. He was given the choice to stay on or to take the big severance package. And we decided, it's like, well, I mean, the severance package was probably, it would have kept us going for maybe 6 months to a year in London. It's like, well, let's take that severance package and see what else is out there. So again, whenever these opportunities have come up, we've always taken them. Yeah.
So being courageous, you just know that it's the greatest reward.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Jennifer, it has been so much fun chatting with you. What is the easiest way for people to find you?
I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at JM Landles. So that's the same hash, the same tag for all of those. That's probably the best place to get in touch with me. But you can also find me on the website, jmlandles.stiffbunnies.com.
Yep, and buy your books, which I am getting ready to do as soon as we get off here, so that I'll even give you a review, which is, that's even more shocking.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love reviews.
I know. We understand that once you need them or they make a difference, you understand reviews. So yeah, I'm super excited about that. Thank you so much for sharing your story. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Well, thank you. It's been fun talking to you. And we have so much in common.
Other than the name, I know.